Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 64, section 7, which is old single column, page 726. All right, so we have this final section. It's a long section, so it may take us the whole time to get through it. They're going to give us a whole bunch more little vignettes of detail about the colored races. As you can tell from the title of the section, specifically what they're up to immediately in the wake of getting themselves founded there in the classic homeland of extreme northwestern India. And don't forget, when they say that in the Arantia book, there wasn't a Pakistan, that was part of India. So, in other words, way up. We're going to get a little bit more on exactly what proclivities each of the races has, naturally, genetically, including tendencies to mate with one another, in an initial, obviously quite natural way without a lot of guidance towards that. The planetary prince and his staff do a little bit of work on that, but not a lot, and especially not a lot in the very early stages that they were still in by the time the rebellion rolled around. But there's some natural tendencies. We all know that hormones are hormones, and they just function. So that sort of thing just happens naturally, one way or another.
Did you say they dysfunction?
they just function. but we are speaking of dysfunction. That's one of the things that's getting into play now as they disperse. You finally are going to have a phenomenon that's going to spread out over the globe and not have such an innate tendency to get dysfunctional and start backmating. There's a much stronger tendency in the Sanghiks to think in terms of going north. If you're a primary Sanghik, there is there's a very strong tendency to not be tempted, no matter how desperate you might get, to backmate. So this is the beginning of a dispersed phenomenon that has a lot greater integrity to endure long term. It may not progress a lot in some areas, but at least it doesn't have such a tendency to retrogress. So they can go on for hundreds of thousands of years and not be slowly drifting ever more downward like the Neanderthals, those original Neanderthals were. All right, so let's just get into it and see what they have for us here.
Number 7, dispersion of the colored races. When the colored descendants of the Sanghik family began to multiply, and as they sought opportunity for expansion into adjacent territory, the fifth glacier, the third of geologic count, was well advanced on its southern drift over Europe and Asia. These early colored races were extraordinarily tested by the rigors and hardships of the glacial age of their origin. This glacier was so extensive in Asia that for thousands of years, migration to Eastern Asia was cut off, and not until the later retreat of the Mediterranean Sea, consequent upon the elevation of Arabia, was it possible for them to reach Africa.
Okay, so they start us off again. As we've noticed, they've done several times, sort of reminding you of when we went through the story of the Ice Age, just looking at the physical issues there. So they're synchronizing the human again with that physical story. So we're in this mode with the next to the last glacial advance. And that bit about, you know, when they say the glacier was so extensive in Asia that for thousands of years migration to Eastern Asia was cut off, your first thought should be, well, couldn't they just go south? You know, through what's now Bangladesh, today, couldn't they? But remember, they're quite a ways up into Central Asia to start with. So their immediate thought is they want to just go east, and they can't because the glacier's there, on the northern side of the Himalayas. And they have a strong tendency to not go south. Now, eventually, especially once the primary Sanghiks do begin to move north and east or west, the secondary Sanghiks don't have as definitive a tendency, to not go southward. So, there you will begin to see more of the secondary Sanghiks, heading southward and working their way down to Southeast Asia, on the one hand, and then, like they were saying, Africa on the other hand. And so, again, we see that rather than it being an out-of-Africa phenomenon, as everything is rationalized today, right, it's an into-Africa phenomenon. The only thing that came out of Africa were some of those near-human stocks that moved up into Europe and fed into the backmating problem. I mean, that's what came out of Africa, was the backmating in Europe. But eventually, you do have Homo sapiens, right? As we're just talk about the Sanghiks scientifically, right? I mean, we now have something that you should call Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens go into Africa, and you have again that reminder about how much the geography is changing right in that immediate area. That not only the peninsula that this all started on with the humans, that's been slowly disappearing. Until, like today, it's totally gone. But at the same time, you have the Mediterranean actually drawing back from the Indian Ocean. It did go all the way through to the Indian Ocean, as they're saying. It's drawing back, and you're having the Arabian Peninsula, appearing, in that new landed area.
Sandbar.
Yeah, right. You've got a very glorified sandbar that's building up. That we know as as that Arabian region now today. Right, so we're getting a lot closer. See, the story is moving into a mode where we're a lot closer to the geography that we know today, but there's still some pretty significant changes that occur over these few hundred thousand years. It's as we've stressed a number of times. It's important to just not forget how over just, say, the last 10, 20,000 years, there have been some very significant changes in the geography of this planet. When we start to think that, when we start to falsely existentialize the world as we find it today, thinking That little coral atoll out in the middle Pacific goes under the water, that's some radical change. It's like, oh, remember, that coral atoll is on top of an island that used to be inhabited by people, and now it's completely underwater when the glaciers melted and the oceans rose significantly. Massive peninsulas have come and gone, and you know, just in a few hundred thousand years, things change a lot. Start putting yourself in the mode of a people that are going to be living on this planet for countless trillions of years forward into the future. A people that are going to be living here over the next 10 million years, say. How much change, you know, is going to naturally occur in the Earth over the next 10 million years? Not to mention how much change will be artificially imposed upon it when the master physical controllers start to really do things radical. All right, but just the natural change that will occur over millions and millions of years going forward in the future. I mean, we have to think in terms of a variable geography that we live in. This is a long ways away from a world settled in the fifth stage of light and life, where the geography that we have right now is eternalized. We're a very long ways away.
You know, when they talk about North America and things like that, and what we've been reading over the last few months, you can't just picture that as what we call it today.
Right.
As you were saying earlier, so, you know, before the continental drift happened, even.
Yeah.
But they're referring to that, those sections, I guess, of what ended up being North America. Yeah. It's a similar kind of thing that's going to happen in the future, I'm sure.
Right, don't be.
Not from so much movement.
Right, I mean, plate tectonics is going to do an awful lot over the next 10 million years. I mean, you know, there'll be radical changes. And the humans are all just going to be going with the flow of that. The continents will be radically different, you know, just by natural processes. We have to be, you know, it's not that we shouldn't be concerned about very ignorant, disruptive impositions on the environment, you know, that we might.
Yeah, and breathing dirty air.
Right, do. But still, you have to keep it in context. You can't think in terms of any change indicates something bad. I mean, it's hard to imagine humans doing something that can change the Earth as much as it's changed naturally over the last, you know, billion years. Think about how polluting it was when meteors were raining down constantly on the Earth. Right? And all the Earth took care of all that pollution. Or how polluting it was when there were just countless massive volcanoes going off all over the Earth. For millions of years, the Earth took care of all of that.
Or how much CO2 there was when there was nothing but vegetation.
Right, and you know, the CO2 used to be radically greater than it is now. Okay.
But Chris, that disruption didn't happen over thousands of years, for one thing, or millions.
Yeah.
It was a very quick thing that kind of leaves us in the lurch, because everything is poisoned.
Well,
the trick about
that, when we think about how, you know, we can envision quote unquote man-made poisons being very aggressive and stuff. Okay, but remember, the reason that things changed very slowly, even though it changed, you know, the amplitudes were great, but you know, your point is well taken. The change from, you know, from one low point, you know, to one high point of some change was, you know, spread over a very long span of time. Why was it spread over a very long span of time in general? Because creatures with very limited mind, very limited adaptability, had to keep up with that change. The greater the mind, right, to him who much is given is much expected. The only reason we're given mind is for adaptability. So don't be surprised if, coincidentally, nature demands more clever, wise adaptation when you can, you know, challenge yourself, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, you have to be kind of suspicious of that. I mean, the very fact that we are, you know, when you begin to move from the material comfort era to the quest for knowledge and wisdom, right, if you actually get into that developmental epoch of the quest for knowledge and wisdom, that's saying that you have a solid knowledge foundation with a definitive wisdom built upon that foundation. You're going to be expected to use that greater mind. And so you should be going, oh, what do you suppose is going to happen? There's going to be challenges that coincidentally will come up that demand that greater mind. So, again, you know, we shouldn't, it's like, well, let's do something just to challenge ourselves to see how wise we are. I mean, again, you know, we're not talking about foolishness like that. But it's, you know, we're reading, you know, what is the first thing they mention, like I said here, the glacial age, right? Just as there's humans, coincidentally, there's this very vigorous, challenging phenomenon. Right? The glacial age is more challenging than anything we can imagine cropping up here in the near future from something we might do. You know, and the humans were expected to meet that challenge or die. Survival of the fittest, right? It's an evolutionary process. The degree to which, you know, we are still inescapably serving that material master, it's a pretty harsh master, right? We'll read about that as we get, you know, towards the end of this section, just how harsh it is. I'm not trying to argue for the other side of some dichotomy. I'm just trying to argue for more objectivity, right? And not let people slip into the ease of one side of a dichotomy. Because it takes no mind to be an ideologue. Everything that you should ever think, how you should respond to every stimulus, is all written down in the doctrine of the ideology. I mean, you can program a computer to be an ideologue. It doesn't even require mind at all. Right? You could easily envision making a sophisticated enough android to be a perfect ideologue in some ideology. It requires no dynamic, you know, functioning in the moment. And humans have been striving for this, you know, like the Pharisees, you know, a great classic example in the New Testament, you know, of a group of people trying to actually write down every possible circumstance that any human could ever get into, and the precise response to that circumstance. See, and we think today, so that you could write a complete computer program, right, and replace the humans with automatons. We have this tendency. See, we're ease-drifting souls. We have this tendency. We're indolent. We're lazy. And we love to imagine a world that doesn't require mind. Right? Everything is given. So just, you know, the whole point when they tell you in the religion papers that you've been pushed out of the sheltered base and you're out on the high seas, what they're telling you is you now are going to be required to use mind like we've never demanded of you before. We're not going to let you, you know, be in that wonderful blue lagoon anymore, right? Because you have the wisdom to handle it now. And guess what? You know, you have no option. I'm just going to shove you out into the high seas and wall off the blue lagoon so that you can never get back there again.
Unless you use your mind.
Some adaptation is taking place,
people
are using their mind.
We've got
maybe just a tiny amount of people, yeah. But it's not all weak either.
Just appreciate that there's a reason God gave us creativity, right? I mean, adaptability is one thing. You know, but to actually bring in creativity, right? Even beyond what I was just talking about, was just mere adaptability, right? Where the only way that you can meet the challenge is with having personality. Right? See, I mean, be careful what you ask for. You know, if you're praying for God to help you grow so that more of your personality can actualize? Well, be careful what you ask for, because he's going to expect you to use that. You're going to be given greater challenge when he sees that you have greater potential. So, did you have... Okay. All right, let's see. So let's get back here. So it does, like I said, it does come back around. That little excursion we just took there, it comes right back around to why they keep mentioning the glaciers. There's nothing coincidental about the Ice Age and when humans began. Right? That's where you very definitively see the physical and the biological not being separate as they appeared, because they're not. They're one evolutionary system. It's all a vast conspiracy. Yep.
So is what you were just saying a minute ago have anything to do with the parable of the talents?
Yes, right. Yeah, to him, as much is given, as much expected. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It really has nothing to do with money.
No. The whole point is, if you're given something, you're going to be, asked to use it. There's, like I said...
And the more you use it, the more you're given?
Yeah, and the more you use it, the more you're grown, and then the more you'll be challenged even again, like we often talk about. I mean, once you can handle a job that currently the Ancient of Days is doing, you have to do it. It's not, would you like to do it, John? No, they'll say, John, this is your assignment, and you say, yes, sir. you must take on these challenges. That's why the revelators use that word must so often in the book. They're trying to tell you the challenge is upon you. You must use the potentials that you are not using right now. It can't be sad to record anymore. You must take a hold of what you have. Don't be deceived by the rebellion and the default into thinking that you don't have what it takes. You have what it takes. If you would just take a hold of it. I mean, it's a mustard seed, right? Like Jesus tried to tell you. You would be amazed at what you could do if you just could find the courage to face greater challenges, and not be that timid soul. All right.
It seemed like the saint gets very sheltered here.
Yeah, see, and again, like we've said so many times, I mean, when you can't make a logical or a moral or some high appeal to someone, right, cattle prods. The environment becomes this giant cattle prod, and it just forces it upon you. I don't want to face the cold. Okay, well, let me put ice all the way around you. Now you have to. Right? Like I said, it's a vast conspiracy. You're not going to escape it. If you're really clever and manage to escape all the challenges, the definitive challenges in this life, guess what? They're waiting for you in the first mansion world. Yeah. You can't get away. God will not be mocked. Right? You can't get around it. So, take on the challenge. Okay.
Thus it was that for almost 100,000 years, these Sangic peoples spread out around the foothills and mingled together more or less, notwithstanding the peculiar but natural antipathy which early manifested itself between the different races.
So remember, as we were reading the list up above at the end of the previous section, I reminded you of them bringing that up, back a ways, about that natural antipathy. So here they're mentioning that again. But notice, they mingled together more or less. Right? Even with that antipathy, biology is still biology. Right? And they're because they can't really get away from each other because of the Ice Age, there's some blending that occurs even there early on in that first 100,000 years. There's going to be some blended tribes that develop. Okay? And And it's important that they give you that for almost 100,000 years, so that you, when you begin to look at the evidence around, the physical evidence of human remains around the world, you don't, start looking for something in Europe, 450,000 years ago, blue man in Europe. You're not going to find him there. Right? It's going to be sometime, the earliest that you're going to find anything out of that really small Central Asian region is, 400,000 years ago. Right? You can look for that, matching up with the current data that we have with human remains, looking more modern or whatnot in some area. You notice this is kind of a rare example of them giving you a little help with a word that they use. They could have just said peculiar, but they decided to say peculiar but natural, just so you didn't pick the improper sense of the word peculiar. In other words, not the sense that basically means unnatural, strange, whatever. But the sense of it has a very specific, definitive, difference from the specifics of this, the particulars of this are of one flavor for the red man, of another flavor for the yellow man, another flavor for the green man. I mean, each of them has their own, I love that skin color more than that skin color, or I love that facial shape, more than that facial shape. That sense of the word peculiar, of that very individuated, each to their own specificity, right? That's what they mean by that. So they're all kind of together there, and they can all, begin to find, these natural slight attractions amidst the general antipathy and get a little bit of blending going. All right.
Between the times of the planetary prince and Adam, India became the home of the most cosmopolitan population ever to be found on the face of the earth. But it was unfortunate that this mixture came to contain so much of the green, orange, and indigo races. These secondary Sangic peoples found existence more easy and agreeable in the Southlands, and many of them subsequently migrated to Africa. The primary Sangic peoples, the superior races, avoided the tropics, the red man going northeast to Asia, closely followed by the yellow man, while the blue race moved northwest into Europe.
You see, I was mentioning that up front, so and you can see some of the differential that they're speaking to when they use superior, inferior to differentiate. A little bit higher mind, a little bit more definitive recognition naturally about the issues with a salubrious clime. That it's not helpful if you don't have some kind of harsh external cattle prods. The primary Sangics appreciated that and would face that fact. Whereas the secondaries, that wasn't so obvious to them. That can be problematic if it's too easy to get food, or whatnot. Right? I mean, if it's too easy to get food, you don't have the challenges that really drive you from that first developmental epoch, the nutrition epoch, into the next one, the security age. Right? I mean, those external stimuli are important to power, to drive humans forward from one developmental epoch to the next. So the primaries, this was more programmed into them, you could say, that was just a recognition that they had and would face the challenges, that are consequent upon that recognition. And you know, and here you see, even though you know, they keep, you notice how they keep mentioning Africa. You know, it's like, well, what about all of you know the southern part of Asia, especially moving all the way to you know into Southeast Asia. Not to mention, we know we have a those group of islands that are just immediately off, you know, very, very Southeast Asia are called, you know, they're not called Polynesia, they're called Melanesia, right? Right, because of the dark-skinned peoples, the secondary Sangiks, right, that are there. Now, you know that those, and those shorter-stocked peoples that are to the south of China, right? I mean, so you know they went to the east as well. But you can't help but notice that they basically knew that we would eventually get ourselves turned around and have everything rationalized as out of Africa. And so they kind of make a point of saying, no, actually it was not out of, it was into Africa. They basically are pointing out that they were, those secondary Sangiks were definitely going south and east, not just south and west to Africa, right? Because they're all flooding down, especially into the lower parts of the Indian subcontinent, some more southern parts. And that's why you have a lot of issues there genetically even today. There was less eventual Andite uplifting, you know, in southern India than in northern India. Plus, you have all this greater tendency for this differential north-south that they're pointing out here between the primaries and the secondaries. You know, so even though all the races mixed there, there's going to be a natural sorting, right, you know, across the north-south direction of this Indian subcontinent.
Recent times when they've gone to these island areas, there's a stratification on the island.
Uh-huh.
People that have arrived later have pushed the natives,
quote, yeah,
quote, up into the hill country. So there's at least two or even three different stratifications of, of racial makeup.
Yep. Yeah, and we'll actually talk about that a little bit because they mentioned the Polynesians here in a little bit. So just in that little, you know, our third paragraph here, you're already basically understanding why all the southern parts of Asia are as you still find them today. Right? I mean, in very short order, they got set up like that from these very natural tendencies, and they really haven't changed since. You know, for hundreds of thousands of years, it's all been just dictated by what they, you know, thumbnail sketched there for you. All right, a little bit here about, what about the primaries?
The red men early began to migrate to the northeast on the hills of the retreating ice, passing around the highlands of India and occupying all of northeastern Asia. They were closely followed by the Yellow tribes, who subsequently drove them out of Asia into North America.
Okay, so we, you know, they already told us quite a bit when we read about the subsection about the red men, about that whole interaction between the yellow and the red. But again, notice who's first off the mark. And who leaves home first? Red man, the spear point. Right, that's just inescapable. He can't help himself. That's just what he does genetically, naturally. He's the spear point race, so he's going to be the first to trek off to the horizon, and he's definitely going to go as north as he can. And you know, why they picked east or west, you know, I don't know, but you know, it may be just the case that, you know, in terms of red man, maybe, you know, he wanted to leave as soon as possible, and maybe he could leave northeast sooner than he could leave northwest, and so that's why he left northwest, or northeast, I mean, excuse me, northeast. Yeah, so it may just be the glacial thing again, you know, and then yellow had this kind of he was interested in red men. They were doing some blending to start with. And so there's this kind of love me, hate me thing that's already building up in an early stage. And so he goes traipsing after red men. And Blue Man says, you know, I think we'll go the other direction. the thing that they mentioned in passing when they talked about red men. So as they go, as these primary Sangiks go north in either direction, they're going to begin to come into interaction with the Andonites. The Andonites, you know, especially once the glaciers back off, the Andonites have always been pushed to the north. And so they're already, you know, north of the Sangiks, when the Sangiks are in their homeland. And so the glacial retreats, the Andonites are moving, you know, north ahead of any primary Sangiks moving north. And so eventually when Red Man gets all the way, you know, to Siberia, he's going to end up blending in to the Andonites there in, you know, northern Siberia. And so the peoples that are there today, see, have a lot of red man in them. They're not as pure Andonite as you find when you go further to the west, you know, then all the way there to the east in Siberia. You know, as you move towards the Urals and, you know, and you know, into Europe, you have a group of Andonite stock that, you know, was left less blended. Okay? And so that, and you see that today because of the Finno-Ugric language group. Right? I mean, it's a group of people that had, you know, a minimal enough amount of imposition of Sangic upon them, and, you know, and then subsequently Andite and stuff, that they have a definitively different language group there of those peoples, that Finno-Ugric language group. See, it's more of an Andonite tongue. Whereas, like I said, if you go, you know, you don't really have a definitively Finno-Ugric language as you go all the way to the east, you know, in the northern part of Siberia there, because of the red man blending in. You know, and everyone, you know, who studies that whole bit of the Amerinds coming across the Bering Strait and over into North America, you know, they look at those peoples right there in Siberia and they notice the similarities to Amerinds in the United States. It's like, well, you know, here's why. Because again, you're mingling with them for a while and yeah, you mate with them. Yeah. So,
Chris, there was just one little thing. Mm-hmm. What is the hails of the retreating ice like? What kind of time frame?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, so recall that this is basically starting about 400,000 years ago that anyone is definitively leaving the Central Asia homeland there. So, you know, this is, you know, they're starting, you know, let's say they're definitively moving away 350,000 years ago. Okay, and they're just moving north and east and north and east, you know, as the glacier lets them. And, you know, at 85,000 years ago, Yellow Man shoves them off Asia. So, you know, over that range of time, they're just being moved, you know, more and more. Because, you know, like I mentioned, Yellow Man is coming right behind him. So, you know, they're just being pushed more and more to the northeast until they literally pushed off Asia.
Slow by lifetime.
Yeah, right. Over hundreds, yeah, several hundred thousand years.
Most of us have no concept of how long 100,000 years is. It's been only 37,000 years since Adam and Eve were here. Uh-huh. I mean, it's almost three times that length of time. It's a long time.
Right. Long, long, long. You know, and remember, there's, they as they move away, the fifth glacier is retreating, but eventually the sixth, you know, advance starts up and is shoving them south again, right? Until finally it retreats, and so you know, there's a whole complicated deal to this. But yeah, Gene's point is, you know, you have to challenge yourself. I mean, I was trying to do that up front with how much, you know, we think, oh my gosh, there's been so much change in the last 10 years. It's just, okay, well, what about the next 100,000? Okay. Humans just don't properly contextualize their interpretations of events. You got to think in bigger terms than we tend to do. But as we've said many times, that's not easy. Adam and Eve found it difficult to have a temporal horizon beyond 100 years.
In a way, we're more used to dealing with the temporal horizon.
Yeah, and just, think about how ingrained long multi-millennial time spans were in a people, you know, that remembered the ebb and flow of the glaciers over those 100,000 years. It was all part of their mythology. You know, they weren't living in the moment like we do now. You know, we'll read this in a little bit here. I mean, they're remembering 100,000 years ago when the glacier was driving them out of their favorite area. Right? They have a memory as a people of that. It's part of their culture. Most people alive today think, you know, that, you know, the United States started in the 60s sometimes. You know, you can ask people on the street, you know, when was the Declaration of Independence? Well, I think it was like 1962 or something like that. You know, I mean, they're just clueless. Right, so... we have to appreciate how, I mean, for instance, a simple example of this yellow man, red man. If you dig around in some of the most ancient mythological stories amongst the Chinese, there's memories of the archer people, old stories about long, long battles that went on for, you know, obviously for thousands and thousands of years with the archer people. That obviously is not written down that long ago, but those stories are back pre-85,000 years ago. They're remembering and they've carried those stories forward through oral tradition until finally they were written down about their endless eternal battle with the archer people, with the red man. Yeah. So we forget about how long people used to, you know, hold on to stuff. You know, and again, that's part of the emergency that we're facing today. Obviously, people our age don't think the United States started in 1962, but you can ask a lot of 20-somethings, and you can get that answer. I mean, they have no clue about, you know, even who we fought in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Right, everyone knows, you know, how those man on the street sort of things, you know, that a lot of people do, right? And how problematic that is, that we're just totally, we're getting more and more animal-like, right? I mean, the more animal-like you think, the smaller the time frame you exist in, the shorter back in time your memory goes, and the shorter into the future your foresight extends. Until finally you're just literally like a housefly living in from second to second, right? And are caught off guard by everything that happens. Comes out of nowhere for you. And that's the emergency. We're slipping into that very circumscribed sense of ourselves. Yeah, and more and more you're saying, well, you know, if I can just have a really great smartphone, I think it embodies all of the history, and it can bring the history into the moment for me. I can just look at the cell phone, and it tells me what to do in the moment. Yeah, that's like the green man, you know, staring at the butterfly between his legs as the indigo man comes in and chops his head off and takes over Africa. Right, that's lambs to the slaughter stuff. All right, so, you know, it's just a tiny little paragraph, because they already have kind of brought all this story of the yellow man and the red man forward, but, you know, they're just wanting to remind you again that key thing. who's first off the mark. It's not, I mean, you don't even have to, you know, look it up. You know who's going to leave first. I mean, the life carriers know he's always first off the mark. You know, and so they're just waiting, you know, for them, the red man, to go and like, all right, we're off to the races. And everyone will, humans love to imitate, so everyone will follow the red man, you know, especially the primary sanguics. They'll be quickly looking to do likewise. All right.
When the relatively pure line remnants of the red rays forsook Asia, there were 11 tribes, and they numbered a little over 7,000 men, women, and children. These tribes were accompanied by three small groups of mixed ancestry, the largest of these being a combination of the orange and blue races. These three groups never fully fraternized with the red man and early journeyed southward to Mexico and Central America, where they were later joined by a small group of mixed yellows and reds. These peoples all intermarried and founded a new and amalgamated race, one which was much less warlike than the pure line red men. Within 5,000 years, this amalgamated race broke up into three groups, establishing the civilizations respectively of Mexico, Central America, and South America. The South American offshoot did receive a faint touch of the blood of Adam.
Okay, so again, before we go into any details, notice in just one paragraph, you got, oh, so that sets up all of North and South America, and you go all the way forward, you know, into very recent times, and yeah, until the Europeans got to North and South America, and it was still there. It was set up almost immediately, you know, with Mexico, with the Aztecs, the Mayans, and the Incas, right? You know, all the precursors to those three. But it just goes forward to the Aztecs, the Mayans, and the Incas. As they're pointing out, that was set up very early on. And, you know, those who are familiar with that last sentence know there's those Polynesian Andites that thought, you know, I wonder what's farther to east as you head off Asia here. You know, and back in those days, you know, whatever that was, 10 to 15,000 years ago, something like that, or maybe a little more than that, the oceans were a lot lower because there was a lot of ice in the glaciers. So there was a lot more Polynesian islands. It was easier to island hop, you know, all the way across and get to South America. And you remember there were 132 Andites that made it all the way across. And, you know, obviously that gave them a little bit of a biologic uplift there. But as they point out, it's not so much a biologic uplift, it's just a cultural inspiration that those Andites brought. And that's why you begin to get that very significant civilization going there in South America, like with Tiwanaku and those sorts of things.
Did they have the blood of Adam?
Yeah, I mean, they were Andites. You know, Andites, you know, heading all the way across the Pacific there. You know, why is Easter Island, you know, what it is? And right, that's all because of those Polynesian Andites. You know, I'm calling them Polynesian Andites because they're Andites heading across Polynesia. Not that they're Polynesians, you know, like we think of, you know, I'm about to mention Polynesians here yet. But those Andites going across Polynesia.
Doesn't it seem like a small number of people? 7,000 people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was going to say, you know, getting into the details. You see, yeah, you know, that's the first thing that strikes you. Again, how small the numbers are in many cases. All these people in North and South America,
today.
You know, all just coming from this handful, relative handful of individuals. You know, and you can imagine how many of them died. You know, in fairly shorter and stuff, rugged conditions. A little over 7,000 left, but I mean, how many, you know, survived by the time you get well down into North America? They're facing all kinds of harsh conditions. I mean, they're going into a whole totally new continent, and there's no traditions about. They've got to figure out, you know, how the game works there, how the climate works there, right? All those details. Okay, and then also, see, point out, as they were all grouped together, there was some blending. You know, back there prior to 400,000 years ago, this orange and blue group. I mean, see, that's not resulting from post dispersion. The oranges are tending to go southward. The blue are tending to go northwest. Right? I mean, you got that orange blue group started right there in the homeland area. Okay. So there was some, there was some mingling. And you see it's not just the yellows want to chase after the reds, in a threatening manner. They're attracted to them to a degree too. There's some yellow-red blending that's very naturally going on to start with and as they move. The yellow may be driving the red, but they're also mating with them in the margins and creating a blended race. Let's see. But in terms of the groups that went to Mexico, Central America, South America, you have this diversity. You know, in terms of what they mention, you have, everything but green and indigo. You have four of the six. And it's, it's interesting. There's, it's like when they find, when they look at some of the artifacts from down there, there seems to be a tradition of these different stocks. You'll see them carve faces, small or sometimes even huge. I remember you find these gigantic, heads that have been carved and stuff. But whether they're carving it huge or small, it's obvious to everyone, the scientists looking at it, it's like, well, they seem to be depicting different types of people. See, and you're going to have some that are definitely going to look more Negroid-like because you have orange, at least. And then the various differentials with the yellow and the red and the blue and so that's most likely why those peoples carve those differences in those faces, because it's a memory of the diversity of the original six races. And you see, we mentioned, I think, last time or time before, in India, with all that cosmopolitan they mentioned, you have these festivals where they celebrate different colors, and everyone will paint their skin different colors, and they have mythologies with blue and whatnot. Yeah, again, it's all remembering the diversity of the colored races.
So while this is going on, mm-hmm. the Dalmatia's there, and the Planetary Prince is there.
Yep.
And which is going on, and I would imagine, seeing as the Planetary Prince is, Alalanadek can probably move around pretty quickly, they're keeping track of all this going on.
Yeah, they're definitely keeping track of all the migrations.
But probably not really doing a whole lot, just letting, evolution do a lot of all this.
I mean, in general, what you're saying, mostly they're just letting things happen naturally. The thing that they're doing, though, is they are drawing the best of all six races to the planetary headquarters. Okay, and so they're developing this community around the planetary headquarters of all six races. So besides them migrating naturally in different directions, there's this artificial imposition of getting some of them all to migrate to the planetary headquarters,
which is not,
and set up shop around there.
North, right? I mean, it's not in the cold climate, right?
No, I mean, it's basically just going to the to the west a little bit. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump to the west from where they're starting.
But we can't see the headquarters.
Well, it's gone now. I mean, that original headquarters was.
Did they see it?
Yeah, I mean, there was the corporeal staff that had built an actual world capital. with a stone wall and, you know, a temple to the Father and, you know. Right. I mean, there was a literal physical headquarters there that these people moved to, and they built homes all around it. You know, they developed a great big city of all these, all six different Sangic races around the planetary headquarters. And you had some blending that the prince's staff were encouraging amongst them. They were getting them all to agree to be peaceful and live together, which means, of course, they're going to begin to intermarry and blend together. You know, they were starting a blended race of people around the planetary headquarters. And but then all that fell apart 200,000 years ago.
Right, but it was doing that for a couple hundred thousand years.
300,000 years, right? They were doing that, yeah. So, and they never, you know, they don't mention that little side issue as they're going through all this natural migration. There was that little bit of artificial migration where people were drawn to those who were intrigued by what was going on there, as opposed to being intrigued by, well, what's clear off, you know, to the northeast, beyond the horizon. So it is the one little remaining thing, you know, in this context, why they mention the faint touch of the blood of Adam. You have a relatively blended stock there that is getting upstepped a little bit, both literally, biologically, and even more significantly, culturally, like I'm saying. So, you see, it's not surprising that you had this kind of unexpected degree of civilization that you found south of North America. And you didn't see so much of that. You know, you didn't see pyramids like the Mayans and the Aztecs were building and stuff, you know, or all this. But remember, a lot of that architectural technology, that's the Andites teaching them that advanced megalithic, you know, technology, you know, stones that are carved so perfectly, they match together, you can't slip a cigarette paper between the two of them, all those stories that you all know about. I mean, that's the Andites, you know, behind all of that more advanced stone technology and stuff. But they're working with a people that have a natural genetic symmetry more because there's quite a bit of blending of the races. Okay? Okay, I think that gets everything in there, doesn't it? Let's keep going here.
To a certain extent, the early red and yellow men mingled in Asia, and the offspring of this union journeyed on to the east and along the southern seacoast, and eventually were driven by the rapidly increasing yellow race onto the peninsulas and nearby islands of the sea. They are the present-day brown men.
Okay, as we would, you know, quote-unquote call them brown men, Polynesians. Okay, you know, the general, you know, the actual literal, you know, Polynesians. They're basically this red-yellow combination. It's like, well, doesn't that make orange? But don't forget you have melanin. Right, you have that brownish black pigment that everyone has, and so you know, not just thinking about red man has red built upon that brownish black melanin foundation, but when you're thinking about blending and thinking about what kind of a color you get, you're thinking, you know, taking what would be just orange, but browning it, okay, because of the melanin. Or, you know, more appropriately, the other way, taking the melanin and making it a little more orange so that it's brown instead of so brownish black, see? I mean, that's really the way to think about how you end up with brown men. You take that swarthy brownish black melanin and you lighten it up, orangeify it a bit to brown. Okay? Yep.
Well, it helps to have a strong sun.
you will, as you see, they don't bring up anything else. I mean, that's the that's the profoundly different group that you need to explain. The Melanesians are, everyone should be able to recognize, are just those that are in Southeastern Asia and got pushed off into the islands a little bit immediately close. But those secondary Sangiks are coming in there later. And so you notice what happens to brown man, the Polynesians, they get pushed out into the farther, more remote islands. So that's why they end up the farthest out in the Pacific, is because they're trying to move away, and eventually they run out of islands. They can't move away anymore of the secondary Sangiks moving into Southeast Asia and spilling out onto the islands a bit and giving you the Melanesians. And then, subsequently you have both groups flowing into Micronesia, also the coming down from, the northern islands too, from the Philippines and stuff, kind of filling out the rest of the islands there in Micronesia. But, what they're doing is they're just trying to, as you think about all the places on the globe, it's like, well, what about the Polynesians? That's obviously a different fact than kind of just what's going on, obviously, relative to Asia. Where did they come from? Right. And if you look at Polynesians, just look at them. It's like, if I blended yellow man and red man, I can see that. If you just study them, you can. It's very obvious, right, that they're a primary Sangic blend of red and yellow. Yeah, they look a little bit like Amerind, but a little bit like Chinese, right? And that's why. Okay. All right. Let's see. Anything else there? Oh, just again, them mentioning there. Despite all of that warring between red and yellow, there's a very definitive tendency for them to intermate, and it just keeps happening over and over again. They mention that. Yep.
Yeah. With regard to the nearby islands.
Mm-hmm.
John Stevens is asking what specific islands.
Well, see, like I was saying, everything, as you come down, off of the mainland of Southeast Asia, and you start to get into all the islands, between there and Australia, right? All Indonesia and all that stuff, and then all, New Guinea and as you move to the smaller islands, further to the east, like, actual Melanesia, the littler islands, all the way out to Fiji and... and then to the north you have Micronesia, but then farther out, you've got Polynesia.
And as you said, there's a lot more of them.
Islands. Yeah, and back in the days they were migrating, there were a lot more islands. Right? I mean, an awful lot of those islands are nothing but, like I said a while back, just a little blob of coral on top of the island that's totally underwater now. Right? It's just like a little halo on the mountain peak, and the whole mountain is under the water now. You go to some of those little islands. I mean, it's literally nothing but just a white bed of coral fragments. Everything is built upon.
Jack Sparrow got. Yeah,
and you can think of all kinds of stories. Yes. Or Bikini Atoll, where we blow up hydrogen bomb.
The one the Chinese are resurrecting. Right?
Yeah, right. You've got little things, and you just pour a little bit more dirt on them. You can have a bigger island, because the actual island is not that much submerged, so it doesn't take too much dirt to actually start to build up a little bit more of an island again. It's just, they're just literally, the mountain peak is just below the surface of the water. Every one of those islands, remember, is just a single mountain. It's a single volcanic mountain coming all the way up from the seafloor. So it's just this cone poking up from the seafloor. Right?
How does the dirt just wash away? I don't see how they
can
do that.
Well, again, it's not that long ago. With them building islands.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they have to keep piling. And
they
same
have
way.
To put cement there, too.
Right. Put in lots of rock. They haul in lots of rock. And, they don't just put sand.
Well, they're using their creativity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they found some green men. They would love doing that stuff.
Think about the Arabs, you know, the kind of stuff, the artificial islands they're building, you know, really fancy stuff. So the whole point here is just to give these thumbnail sketches so that we can appreciate, okay, I understand the basics of North and South America, I understand the basics of Oceania, I understand, they're just giving you, it just takes a few paragraphs and you really have all of the basics, sorted out. Okay.
The yellow race has continued to occupy the central regions of Eastern Asia. Of all the six colored races, they have survived in greatest numbers, while the yellow men now and then engaged in racial war. They did not carry on such incessant and relentless wars of extermination as were waged by the red, green, and orange men. These races virtually destroyed themselves before they were finally all but annihilated by their enemies of other races.
Okay, so we touched upon it again, but I wanted to remind you of the lesser tendency for internecine war with the yellow men, and so the sons of Han grew vast, right? Unlike red men had just a little over 7,000. The sons of Han, grew to millions and millions. They didn't kind of sum it up like this before. The really problematic ones were red, green, and orange. Those three with the internecine war. Let's see, anything else there? I guess we basically have that. I suppose the only other thing to mention is they're bringing in like brown man and red man. Just for new readers of the Revelation, it is a challenge to face those words. They've heard, red and yellow, black and white, or something like that. I mean, they've heard, heard people rattle off these colors, but they probably haven't stopped. Literally think red and literally think yellow, and to not think of them sort of metaphorically or mythologically or something, right? But literally, even with yellow man, it's built upon that melanin foundation, that brownish black foundation. But anyone with any honesty with themselves throughout all of human history has looked at the sons of Han and said, yeah, okay, they're brownish black like we all are when we get tan dark, but there seems to be a yellow, tint upon that foundation, right? And so they've always been known as yellow man, not because I want to call you yellow because I think that's derogatory or something. It's just a fact. Right? And so that's another, remember, it's only in recent times that we've begun to do what Jesus talked about. There's none so blind as those who will not see. We've begun to willingly blind ourselves to the obvious. Like when we talk about red man and yellow man, the reason we have those terms is because people spoke factually and honestly in the past about this. Red man knew he was red. He was certainly redder than yellow man. And yellow man knew he was yellow. At least certainly yellower than red man. Right? if nothing else, the two of them being together there for so long made it clear.
But you bring up an important issue.
Yeah.
And that is that this particular section here are, for those who are new readers and for people who aren't thinking like you're talking about in depth, it's a challenge for them.
Yeah.
Those particular sections.
We've gone from facing the facts of different races, and challenging ourselves to move upward, to transcend the natural, you know, as they said here, you know, at the beginning, that natural aversion that we, you know, have one race to the other, right? I mean, the peculiar natural antipathy, as they said there, right? I mean, we've gone from always just matter-of-factly facing those facts and then challenging ourselves to move up to a harmony that exists above those differentials, to now trying to convince ourselves that there are no such facts and that we're just innately unity, right? Which, of course, when we try to convince ourselves that we're innately unity, we don't even know what unity means. What we actually are talking about is innately uniform. We don't think spiritually. We don't literally aren't thinking the spirit word unity. We're thinking the material shadow of that uniformity. You know, and so again, we're doing just like Jesus' apostles. It's like, no, I'm not talking about matter. I'm talking about spirit, right? And you're interpreting it as matter. You're looking for spirit unity, you know, this unity, spirit word unity in matter. Well, the only thing you're going to find is uniformity, and that's not easy to find unless you sort of really in totalitarian fashion impose it upon, you know, the matter. You will be unity-like, uniform. This is the emergency, that decay of naturally facing facts and using your philosophic mind to challenge yourself to go up and not deny those, not close your eyes to those facts, but discover how when you go up, those facts come together. They aren't oil and water. I could go on forever on that. Don't get me on that soapbox. It's part of the emergency. It's a big problem. All right. Let's keep going here.
Since the fifth glacier did not extend so far south in Europe, the way was partially open for these Sangik peoples to migrate to the northwest. And upon the retreat of the ice, the blue men, together with a few other small racial groups, migrated westward along the old trails of the Andon tribes. They invaded Europe in successive waves, occupying most of the continent.
Okay, the interesting details follow here next, because we all know, it's like, well, what about the Neanderthals that we've... we already have there, but you know, initially, see, they're just giving you something in parallel to what they told you about the red and the yellow. Okay, so the blue men go northwest instead of northeast, and you know, we kind of mentioned before that, you know, these massive sheets of ice ebb and flow across the land, but things aren't utterly altered. You know, so you still have the old trails of the Andon tribes. You still have the basic ways that you migrate across the continents are still, you know, effectively there. And you follow the similar routes that everyone has always followed.
Their Google
Map. Right. And they pull out their Google Maps or, you know, or whatever, and off they go. And so we have, upon the retreat of the ice blue men. Oh, the ice, the blue men. I always notice as I'm reading it, because put the ice and the blue together. But it's kind of a fun thing, you know, when you think about how blue that glacial ice is, right? That the blue man, it's like, oh, there's something about it. It's love, you know. it looks like me.
It's funny that you can notice, you know, orange, green tints and mm-hmm. different things, and yellow and red, but you don't see much blue.
Right, and we're just about to, you know, talk about that a little bit more. Why, you know, why is it when people rattle off these colors, even though they don't take them seriously, when they were talking about everyone on the planet, they'll say black and they'll say brown and they'll say be white and they'll say red and they'll say yellow, but they never say blue. Right? And why is that? We need to answer that question. Right, they talk about blue bloods, but right, but you know, that's obviously different.
I think you wanted to go see a show in Las Vegas, The Blue Man.
Yeah, and it's not because, oh, are they talking about white men and they're so white and their skin is so translucent that you can see the blue veins? No, that's not what we mean by blue man. We mean blue. We're meaning, you know, someone who is mongoloid. You know, in basic body form and depth of tone in terms of the skin color. Again, you're starting with that brownish black melanin and you're just yellowing it or redding it or bluing it, right?
Like the yellow submarine. Bluish.
Okay. But we already know a little bit of the story that we know, remember they told you with the blue men, that there was some red and some yellow that kind of went with them and blended in. So you had, even before they got to Europe, they were browned out to a degree. Right? And then you get the rest of the story here in a second. But you got a question first?
I'm like confused. When you mix yellow, or I mean red and green, you often get a blackish tone.
Yeah.
And so, but I'm confused also about the blue with the Mongolian, because I just never thought of blue.
Right, again, the blue man is not going to Mongolia.
Blue, where does he go?
To Europe.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't think of any.
The Mongolians, you're talking about yellow man, and then you know, as you get north of China proper, you're blending in some more red, like they're telling you. So you get more red-yellow. Okay. See, and again, you're not going to picture blue man anywhere. That's what we're just talking about. And we need to understand why. Why is it that there's no people on the planet that anyone has ever said, you know, they're kind of bluish, right? It's a two-step process. Well, it's a three-step process, actually. First step I was just describing. We'll get to steps two in a second here. The first step is take the blue man and blend in some red and yellow. Okay, you blend in, you know, all three primary sanguine colors, right? And you're going to get brown. Okay, you're going to brown it out.
That's one way.
Right? Okay. And then, on top of that, let's read a little bit more here and get the part two in this process.
In Europe, they soon encountered the Neanderthal descendants of their early and common ancestor, Andon. These older European Neanderthals had been... Neanderthalers had been driven south and east by the glacier and thus were in position quickly to encounter and absorb their invading cousins of the Sangik tribes.
Notice how they describe that. To encounter and absorb. Because we got this little band, relatively little band of blue man, you know, going towards Europe. And you have the Neanderthalers that have been there, you know, since 850,000 years ago. They've been there for 500,000 years already. There's a lot of them, okay? And yes, like they said, you mate the Sangiks with the Andonites, and there's a tendency to pass the skin color along, okay? But you've got a drop of blue in an ocean of brown. You're going to wash it out to a high degree. You know, as you take that little bit of blue and just wash it into the vast numbers of Neanderthalers. So it gets browned a little bit just by the three primary Sangiks blending. And then, you know, you mix it with lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of just, you know, Andonic skin color. not to mention what other things might be going on with all of that backmating stock that's in there. And okay, but I mean, you on the one hand, there's two ways to talk about what's in Europe. Eventually, they'll be talking about how there's blue man in Europe. Okay, here it's more important to talk about what's in Europe is the Neanderthals made new. Right? What humans, you know, what current human scientists call Neanderthal man is not those old Neanderthalers like they're talking about here. It's this these new Neanderthalers when you blend in the Sangic stock. And you know, so humans think that the Neanderthals sprung onto the scene. Numbers vary, but you know, let's say 350,000 years ago, 300,000 years ago. See, you know, because that's when the blue man got to Europe. And he starts heading there sometime after 400,000 years ago. And so the earliest that there might be blue man mixing in with the Neanderthals would be 400,000, okay? Somewhere between 400,000 and, say, 200,000 years ago. They're going to get all blended in at some point in there, right? You're going to think there's these new people on the Earth, right, that we call Neanderthal man. But, see, scientifically, like I said, you shouldn't call them Homo Neanderthalensis. Homo Neanderthalensis is what you should call these, you know, improved Andenites that have been going on for 500,000 years. You should call these new Neanderthals Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis. You should make the Neanderthalensis a subspecies instead of a species. So when scientists argue about which should you call Neanderthal man Homo Neanderthalensis or Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis, the answer is yes. It depends on whether it's before blue man blends in or after blue man blends in. And after blue man, it should be Homo sapiens, it's Sangic, but it's this modified, right, with all of this andonic stock and all the other backmating stuff blended into it. Okay, and so just so you see it, what they're describing here for the timing of them migrating matches right up with what you know, we have for our understanding of when Neanderthal man appeared on the scene. Okay, as opposed to all the confusions about Homo heidelbergensis and Homo erectus and all that stuff. Yep.
That's a strong blow to my bias. Even after years of the book, I still have the notion that Neanderthal man was pretty much exterminated by blue man. Not true.
No. And see, it says it right there. He wasn't exterminated. I mean, the exterminating didn't begin until you brought Adamites into Europe, mating with the best of these Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis, and getting an even more new and improved blue man. Right, then that new, you know, yeah, the Adamites went in there. Right? Eventually, many papers forward, we'll get to that story. When you have that very new and improved blue man, you know, with that Adamic uplift, okay, now the extermination begins. And so when you look at when humans think that Neanderthal man disappeared, notice when that occurred. They say it was something like about 40,000 years ago. Yeah, right. See, as soon as you have those upstepped with the Adamic blood, blue men, they exterminated all of the baser orders. You know, especially the ones that, I mean, these groups might have, you know, exterminated some of the really backmated stuff, right? The Homo Neanderthalensis that was very degraded. Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis might have exterminated some of them. But, you know, the margins, they were probably still around. But once you get some, some very definitive Adamic upstepped peoples, they're going to be ruthlessly exterminating all the baser orders. And they're going to have a desire to go to the, you know, to the horizons in that Andite way like no one has ever done. And so sure enough, they say scientists say Neanderthal man started somewhere in the, 300,000, 350,000, and disappeared at 40,000. Yeah, of course they did, because they were exterminated.
Can you tell me where I get the notion to call baser, ignorant males that I run across Neanderthal? Because I always call them that.
Right, and how that got started, that derogatory use of Neanderthal, is because there was a very early, disease deformed skeletons that were found, and so there was this mythology that built up that Neanderthal man was this snarling hulk that couldn't even stand upright and stuff. No, that was a diseased, arthritic or whatever individual, right? I mean, regular Neanderthal man stands tall and mighty, right? And would put all of us to biologic shame. Right.
Foxhole, Cro-Magnon,
get away from me. Knuckle-dragger can't go wrong. Yeah, I mean, poor Neanderthal man. I mean, and again, remember, they're just Andonites, right? I mean, they're us. And they say, I wonder if the Neanderthals actually blended in. It's like, no, we all, I mean, Where did the Sangiks come from? They came from the Andonites. What are Homo Neanderthalensis? That's just a version of Andonites. We're all this. We're all humans. A non-degraded Andonite would have been very, very human looking. As we think, just not as. They're not going to have the sharp angular features that are coming in from Adamic blood. I mean, no evolutionary stock has as definitive of sharp features and stuff, because that's coming from Adam and Eve. Okay, but in terms of the Andonites, the pure Andonites had less hair than most Europeans, because the Europeans have hair because they're of the back mating. Get some guy in Europe with a carpet on his back, that's because of back mating. Right, that's
no pun intended. Carpet on his back.
Yes, you can run with it as you desire.
That was pretty good.
All right. They were basically hairless, fully upright, noble form. They lived as long. What have we read? Their longevity was 75 years, right in between 70 years and 10, or by reason of strength 80. Right. I mean, they were fully human. Okay.
I want to finish this.
Yep. We should keep chugging here. So the whole point here is you have you now have what we call Neanderthal man, Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis. So a little bit more on them.
In general, and to start with, the Sangik tribes were more intelligent than, and in most ways far superior to, the deteriorated descendants of the early Andonic plainsmen. In the mingling of these Sangik tribes with the Neanderthal peoples led the immediate improvement of the older race. It was this infusion of Sangik blood, more especially that of the blue man, which produced that marked improvement in the Neanderthal peoples exhibited by the successive waves of increasingly intelligent tribes that swept over Europe from the east.
See, and that's the what the scientists have the record of. See, is that part of the story there. And see, you notice there the deteriorated descendants, because they're, because even remember they said that when you first started with the Neanderthal race, there was very limited tendency to backmate, but we've got 500,000 years here, so you know, slowly but surely over time, there's more backmating, and it deteriorates and deteriorates. Yeah, and like I said, I mean, the blue men are not going to be mating with those most deteriorated ones. They're going to be selective. They're going to be picking the better ones. Okay, I think we can keep going there. Oh, yep.
Just a real quick clarification. Mm-hmm. So Pam's asking, she's still confused about backmating.
Mm-hmm.
She said, who did they backmate with, the primates?
No. It's all those stocks that they don't talk about much directly in the book, but you have, we know of all those peoples, not patients, they people, all those creatures that were evolving in Africa, that drifted north into Europe. I mean, we've been studying all that skeletal remains for years now, starting with the Leakeys and going forward, right? There's all those strains of near-human stock. They're biologically compatible stocks that those Andonites in Europe mated with. But, you know, so they're biologically compatible, but they don't have human-quality mind.
They mated with them. They didn't marry them.
Yeah, they're just mating. It's going to be very primitive culture and stuff, right, in many cases. Right, I mean, as we'll see when we get to the next paper, right, it's a very, very complex phenomenon with all these different strains. It's when you think back, when I say backmating, don't think just physical. In many ways, some of those other strains might have been better physically. The mind quality is lesser. I mean, that's the back. You're going back mindily.
What they say is that the more backward races got upstepped by
yep.
the blue.
Right.
Whereas when they talk about today, you know, they talk about, the deterioration you would get more downstepped. You might think that they would get, that the Sangays would be downstepped by the lower.
Well, but see, the whole point, yeah, I mean, yes, technically, the Sangay gets downstepped. But see, like to keep point out, you really are just putting a little blue drop into a big Andonite ocean, right? And so,
yeah, and the others
disappear. Right. I mean, the blue man is just disappearing. You know, I mean, yeah, technically it's downstepping, but you know, I mean, actually he's just melting into the Andonic peoples and upstepping them a little bit. Okay.
During the following interglacial period, this new Neanderthal race extended from England to India. The remnant of the blue race left in the old Persian peninsula later amalgamated with certain others, primarily the yellow. And the resultant blend, subsequently somewhat upstepped by the violet race of Adam, has persisted as the swarthy nomadic tribes of modern Arabs.
Okay, so again, what tendencies to intermate do they have? Here's another one where blue and yellow get together. Okay, so technically you're getting green, right? But again, you have this brownish black foundation. Which you are moving a little bit green, but it's not going to come off that green. again, you know, they sort of just resort to that swarthy word, you know, that it's just dark color. All right. You know, not to mention you throw in a little bit of washing out the color with the violet rays. And as long as they're mentioning that washing out the color with a little violet rays, that's the third step in ending up with modern Europeans, especially northern Europeans. So you take the blue, you brown it out with some red and some yellow, then you wash it into a whole bunch of anhydrous stock, and then you whitewash it, you know, with, you bleach it basically, right, with the adamic stock, right? And so, you know, you end up with just this extremely faint brown, which we call white. Right. But see, again, you know, you see the point in a little passing vignette. It's like, well, what about you know, apart from the Fertile Crescent influence with the Adamites and the Andites, what about those basic Arab peoples? How do I understand them? See, so they throw in that little bit. It's just like the Polynesians. They're trying to give you all the basic little pockets of, well, that's a little different. Why? Yeah, just so that you can kind of roughly have an understanding. Now, the next thing they're going to say is, okay, you know, we're trying to, okay, I got that sorted out. I got that sorted out. And they want to make sure you're not getting too certain about this, and so they throw in the following little caveat here.
All efforts to identify the Sankic ancestry of modern peoples must take into account the later improvement of the racial strains by the subsequent admixture of Adamic blood.
And it's a mustard seed thing. It doesn't take much. So, you know, it's very difficult to kind of assess. It's like, oh, I want to really go and think about Arabs, and I know what blue and yellow is together. Well, first of all, you know, another reason why it didn't end up being sort of a green-eyed brownish black, you know, they said primarily the yellow, you noticed there, so there's some other little stuff, you know, so it's going to be browned out. But you throw in a little bit, you know, there's also nautite. Remember, there's a little bit nautite thrown in, especially in the Near East there. Right? There's some nautite thrown in and some Adamic blood thrown in. And it doesn't take much to significantly alter it. So, you know, if you go to Bangladesh and there's this very famous person that won a Nobel Prize, say, you're like, oh, well, that shows you that even if it's got a lot of secondary Sankic, they can still, no, look at him. Look at a picture of him. Oh, he looks Andite. Right. I mean, you just don't get that more advanced individual unless you've thrown in some Andite blood, and you're going to see the sharper chiseled features stuff, right? Most likely, right? More often than not. Right. That Adamic blood will show itself not just, you know, in body form, but in mind quality. Right? You'll have a greater potential for a higher mind quality when you have that Adamic uplift. Yeah. All right.
The superior races sought the northern or temperate climes, while the orange, green, and indigo races successively gravitated to Africa over the newly elevated land bridge which separated the westward retreating Mediterranean from the Indian Ocean.
Okay, so they're reminding us of that little fact again, because obviously they're going to give us a little bit about what becomes of the secondary Sangics, because they've kind of taken us through the primaries here, including the immediate primary blends like blue-yellow and red, yellow, and stuff. Okay.
The last of the Sankic peoples to migrate from their center of race origin was the Indigo Man, about the time the green man was killing off the orange race in Egypt and greatly weakening himself in so doing, the great black exodus started south through Palestine along the coast, and later, when these physically strong indigo peoples overran Egypt, they wiped the green man out of existence by sheer force of numbers. These indigo races absorbed the remnants of the orange man and much of the stock of the green man, and certain of the indigo tribes were considerably improved by this racial amalgamation.
Yeah, the last little bit I think we mentioned before when we were talking about the secondary sangics in Africa. Now, if you take the orange, green, and indigo and blend them together in a quite symmetric way, you're going to get very, very, very dark brown man. You're going to get, you know, you're going to get ebony man. You're going to get black man. And this considerably improved by that, you know, that you can often see that very definitively, that those tribes that have such a balanced blend like that will end up being the tribes that the leaders come out of. You know, when you've got a big country now with lots of different tribes, you know, encompassed by the boundaries of that country, you know, don't be surprised if the leaders of those people, you know, say in Kenya, say, or something, tend to come out of those more balanced blends, right? There's just a more balanced mind function there, and hence it's easier for the spiritual ministries to be lifting that mind up and having them think in more objective terms, and they can serve as leaders more effectively. They're about to stress it again, so I won't dwell on it here, but, you know, they say the great black exodus, you know, again, we talked about that, you know, technically it's the great indigo exodus, but so much of why we call black man is because the indigo, you know, and especially if you take indigo and throw in anything else a little bit, it's going to be very dark, right? You're starting with that brownish black foundation of the melanin, right? And the indigo is, you know, is just tweaking that a little bit. If you throw in a little green and orange, okay. Right. You know, that basic story, and again, a couple important things here that they throw in about his genetic nature and how his what a natural mind nature he has attuned to that. Red man was first, who's last? And see, again, it's just built in. They're going to be the most place-like individuals, the least likely to head off from somewhere unless they're drug off from where they are as slaves.
But it's also interesting the timing of how, you know, the green man was killing off the orange race and his numbers got down to low.
Right.
And the indigo race moved in.
Yep.
Just timing-wise, it was and because of sheer numbers, they just got them.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, and if they hadn't been in war and killing off the others, it might have been a different story.
Yeah, especially, remember, the little footnote to that is, because the giant strange in the orange and green, I mean, if they had the numbers, you know, in the orange and green, I mean, along with the giant strains, the indigo man wouldn't have been able to take them. But because, you know, they're getting shorter and shorter. Blue man is getting pretty short, and now indigo man is quite short. And you say, well, I don't see intense shortness in Europe. Well, again, remember, you have the Andonites, all those Neanderthals that they blended into, right? So the stock doesn't end up being as short as it would be if it was more pure blue man, right? But the fact that indigo is the shortest of them all, yeah, you can get pygmies in Africa, really short people, because indigo is the shortest stock.
And yet you think of black in our country as being tall.
Right, because like we talked about, there's obviously some of that giant strain that, you know, you're looking for slaves, and you find these really tall ones. Ooh, I'll take that one, right?
Or the MBA.
And then, yeah, yeah, and then once you get the MBA, it's a totally different effect, yeah. But notice, you know, the other important thing in there, when these physically strong indigo peoples overran Egypt, see, right there they're directly pointing out, which of the six adjutants does Indigo Man favor? The first, all right, the physical foundation adjutant, right? They're just innately going to be strong because they're so naturally attuned to the material foundation mindily. That and the numbers and orange and green are going to fade from the earth. All right, keep going here.
And so it appears that Egypt was first dominated by the orange man, then by the green, followed by the indigo, black man, and still later by a mongrel race of indigo, blue, and modified green men. But long before Adam arrived, the blue men of Europe and the mixed races of Arabia had driven the indigo race out of Egypt and far south on the African continent.
And so, you know, how did you get, it's set up where you have sub-Saharan Africa on the one hand, right, and Saharan Africa on the other hand. And you notice it's a complicated thing, you know, in the northern part of Africa. There's a lot of blending into that area. And
the blue men didn't only go to northern Europe.
Right. Yeah, and then, of course, we know that you get this whole interaction going on between northern Africa and southern Europe, you know, which gives you the southern white race in Europe, you know. And, why do we say that some southern European people have olive skin, i.e. slightly green skin, right? It's because of the green man, and, and those northern African peoples that blended into the southern European peoples. It's not because they eat lots of olives, right? And it dyes their skin green, right? Instead of it being blue, right?
It's like holding your breath to get
blue. Right. You know, just notice, we all matter-of-factly said things like, they're kind of olive-skinned peoples, right? Why? Because there's some green man and in that southern white race. Let's see, and the other thing you notice when they're initially talking about Africa, all they're talking about is Egypt. I mean, there's this tendency as these peoples are going to Africa, they get just into Africa, they get into Egypt, and really don't go any further to begin with. It isn't until you have more primary Sangic phenomena, Nodite, Adamite, Andite, whatnot phenomena, that you push the secondary Sangic stock south, just like it got very much pushed south in the Indian subcontinent by the Andites and the primary Sangics more to the north. Right? So they're always getting shoved. They have a tendency to go south, and then they get shoved even further south, by those that don't want to go south. We're going to be in the, if we're all going to be in India, we're going to be in the northernmost part of India. We more Andite upstepped peoples, and you're going to have to be in the south. All right. I think we got everything else there, didn't we? Yeah,
we can go. Far enough south, and that salubrious climb starts to get challenging.
Yeah.
In itself.
Yes. Right, all of the disease and and difficulties, when you really get equatorial,
As the Sangic migrations draw to a close, the green and orange races are gone. The red man holds North America, the yellow man Eastern Asia, the blue man Europe, and the indigo race has gravitated to Africa. India harbors a blend of the secondary Sangic races, and the brown man, a blend of the red and yellow, holds the islands off the Asiatic coast. An amalgamated race of rather superior potential occupies the highlands of South America. The pure Andinites live in the extreme northern regions of Europe and Iceland, and in Iceland, Greenland, and northeastern North America.
And you start assuming the little words just disappear. It's always a challenge when you're reading. Okay, so you see again, so when all is said and done, they give you just an even more thumbnail sketch of, you know, who's where, like we were saying. That's the whole point, is kind of get, how do you have, you know, how did you end up with the quote-unquote aboriginal peoples in the different parts of the world? Before the Andite invasions, you know, changed everything. Again, that superior potential thing that gets upstepped by the Andites there in South America. And finally, we get a little bit like, well, what about just the better Andinites? Are there any better Andinites left? Like I said, they haven't really mentioned them, but you do have them shoved sort of straight north, in Europe. And then you have this even more pure group that is over there in England and eventually gets shoved off and all the way over to North America. Is there just about to describe here?
Walking?
No, we're just about to, about to read about it here. That's the little footnote is to explain these Andinites that they just teased us about there. But let's see, I just want to make sure, do we get everything there? You got to love, the Indigo race has gravitated to Africa. You know, just to picture that, you know, that north-south differential as being material gravity, just literally, inexorably dragging them southward. And the more that you don't challenge yourself to have that spiritual gravity lifting up your mind, you're going to have a tendency to gravitate to the salubrious climes because of your material gravity mind as well. All right, what's the story of these Andinites here?
During the periods of farthest glacial advance, the westernmost of the Andon tribes came very near being driven into the sea. They lived for years on a narrow southern strip of the present island of England, and it was the tradition of these repeated glacial advances that drove them to take to the sea when the sixth and last glacier finally appeared. They were the first marine adventurers. They built boats and started in search of new lands, which they hoped might be free from the terrifying ice invasions. And some of them reached Iceland, others Greenland, but the vast majority perished from hunger and thirst on the open sea.
I told you that would come up about how harsh it was. You know, see, the vast majority perished on the open sea.
Last paragraph just say northeast and North America.
Yeah, well, they haven't gotten there yet. There's more paragraphs. Notice again, so on the one hand, you have this very fearful thing, you know, that they're remembering over hundreds of thousands of years, the curse of the ice. Now you see how their tradition remembers them, you know, the ebbs and flows over those hundreds of thousands of years. That's all in their tradition, like I told you, it was there. And, they're hanging by their fingernails on the southern edge of England, you know. Ice has just about shoved them, snowplowed them right into the sea. But again, even the red man, as spear point progressive as he is, more, you know, relative to the others, naturally more progressive. Did he build boats? No. What did it take to build boats? Yeah, you had to have an external environment that just, you know, there was no other option, right? You either build a boat or you die, because the ice is just shoving you into the water, right?
Die on a boat.
Right? But, see, you know, it's...
Those
external influences are indispensable. They're very powerful. You know, they need to drive you going. But eventually, all good things taken to extreme become bad. Eventually, when you need to have an inner life, so that you can be religious, distinct from an outer life, you have to prevent this very powerful environmental stimulus from oozing in and diluting and dragging your religious life down, and it's so that it's not religious anymore. It becomes natural, right? The environment naturalizes the unnaturalness of religion, like they tell you up in the religion papers, right? And you lose that genuine inner life. The environment drags you down, you know, and it doesn't have to be a negative environment like the curse of the ice, right? It can be the delights of the outer life, right? Whatever it is, a million different ways, but one way or another, if you don't artificially prevent it, the environment will wash in and degrade your religious life down to nothing.
Wait a minute, I don't have to let that happen, right?
You don't. Well, no, you if you
I, I'm not
going to
let that happen.
If you don't choose to not let it happen, it will happen.
It's not happening.
It naturally happens. Again, just reminding you of how unnatural genuine religion is.
It's happening all around us, though.
Yeah, and even if you get it, if you don't choose to maintain it, you will lose it. The environment will drag you back down again.
When he speaks of environment, not necessarily talking about, you said, cataclysm and things.
I know.
But I bet you 10-1, you're here today. Something caused you to get involved.
Yeah. Right. What we're talking about is, here, religion is designed to change man's environment, but much of the religion found among mortals today has become helpless to do this. Environment has all too often mastered religion. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Right there in the religion papers. A paragraph devoted to just this one fact. It's a very important fact.
Right?
Slowly but inexorably, the church that I belong to is becoming more and more a community center and less a place of worship.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if it's not true worship, maybe it's better for it to be that for now.
Again, don't go into this too much. I just wanted to throw that in to remind you of, right? I mean, there's huge, you know, ramifications between the lines of them, of us talking about these poor Andonites being pushed out onto the open seas, right? I mean, this is, you know, takes you all the way into, you know, paper 103 in the religion papers. All right. Okay, let's get to more of the story here with the Eskimos.
A little more than 80,000 years ago, shortly after the red man entered northwestern North America, the freezing over of the North Seas and the advance of localized fields on Greenland drove these Eskimo descendants of the Urantia Aborigines to seek a better land, a new home, and they were successful, safely crossing the narrow straits which then separated Greenland from the northeastern land masses of North America. They reached the continent about 2,100 years after the red man arrived in Alaska. Subsequently, some of the mixed stock of the blue man journeyed westward and amalgamated with the later day Eskimos. And this union was slightly beneficial to the Eskimo tribes.
See, so notice again, they just made a point to mixed stock of the blue man. So again, nowhere did you end up with anything that was blue enough, you know, pure enough blue, you know, for us to have some. You know, I think those people are blue. It's just, you know, there isn't any place. The closest you get is not biologic, but language. The Basque have a non-Indo-European language because it's Blue Man tongue, right? But in terms of their biology, they're not blue, right?
So it was Blue Man tongue?
Yeah, Basque is not an Indo-European language, and no one is really quite. And they can tell genetically there's a lot older, an older nature to the genetics of the Basque too. I'd say it's because it's pre-Andite, Sangic sort of stock there. Okay, but anyway, isn't it fascinating that coincidentally they're coming both from the east and the west into America almost exactly the same time? That's kind of a fascinating little coincidence. Totally different reasons. Yellow man's driving red man off, right, into Alaska. But these guys are just trying to get away from the ice, and they actually could walk that last leg. You see, there was actually some land there that they could journey across. Okay, so by the time they get to North America, see, you don't have pure andonite. And so you can't say, look to an Eskimo, that's what a pure andonite looks like. No. And you can imagine maybe even that they got kind of shorter if they blended in some blue. But it's like, well, yes, but was it, that short? I mean, it was also blended in with the taller ones, the Neanderthalers. Or, you don't really know. It says mixed stock. It's hard to know how to rationalize it. Okay, what else? We got this last little bit here. Let's keep going.
About 5,000 years ago, a chance meeting occurred between an Indian tribe and a lone Eskimo group on the southeastern shores of Hudson Bay. These two tribes found it difficult to communicate with each other, but very soon they intermarried, with the result that these Eskimos were eventually absorbed by the more numerous red men. And this represents the only contact of the North American red man with any other human stock down to about 1,000 years ago, when the white man first chanced to land on the Atlantic coast.
See, and then that clinches it. You take the tallest of all the Sangics, the red man, and you blend it into the Eskimos. Well, and actually it was kind of the other way. The Eskimos blended into the red man. And so you end up with something that isn't genetically that different. It just has the cultural legacy of that Andonic culture differential to the red man culture. Yeah. So again, you just can't go to the Eskimos and say, oh, that's what an Andonite looks like. There's all kinds of stuff blended in. And then, of course, down to about 1,000 years ago, when the white man first chanced to land on the Atlantic coast, who are we talking about? The Vikings. Yep, my people made it to North America 1,000 years ago. My heritage literally goes back to Leif Erikson. So those guys that did venture there, and there was some little bit of mating that went on there too. Well, you get to you get way into Canada, and North Dakota area and stuff, and the first fur trappers are getting in there and they find blue-eyed Indians. because the Vikings came down into Hudson Bay and stuff long ago. Yeah. No, they definitely, there was some bit of upstepping there from the Vikings. All right, then the last little bit here. This is a really fun final paragraph here that they give us.
The struggles of these early ages were characterized by courage, bravery, and even heroism. And we all regret that so many of those sterling and rugged traits of your early ancestors have been lost to the later day races. While we appreciate the values of many of the refinements of advancing civilization, we miss the magnificent persistency and superb devotion of your early ancestors, which oftentimes bordered on grandeur and sublimity. Presented by a life carrier resident on your rancha.
So why? They appreciate the refinements, but we miss the magnificent persistency and superb devotion of your early ancestors, which oftentimes bordered on grandeur and sublimity. Why? Why do they miss it? Because it's sad to record. Right? You have to have courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Right? And it begins with a biologic foundation that's sadly not there much anymore. We're at best timid souls, and at worst wimps, they're basically saying. Right? Most of you are pitiful. Right? You couldn't stand up the harsh, environment if you had to. Right? So if you can't stand up to a harsh physical environment, how are you going to stand up to a harsh mental environment? How are you going to master yourself? All of ourselves are a harsh mental environment with all these cross currents from all these random blendings and almost no biologic uplift. It's a harsh environment in your mind, right? And you don't have the ruggedness, the sterling and rugged traits. Truth is rugged. It's like, well, yeah, my mind may be, difficult, but truth is just so wonderful and blissy. No, truth is rugged. That requires more courage than your mind, than just your basic cross currents in your mind. Right? Warning, not for those timid souls. Right? That's how they end, with it's sad to record that there isn't conditions anymore that foster those who can take on the challenge of courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Okay. Courage, bravery, even heroism. Okay. Just, and yet you think about, yes, but back there was bloody, there was war and all this sort of stuff. Okay, in fact, yes. But what they're not talking about the fact here, are they? They're talking about the truth that flowed through those people, right? And it's in very short supply now. So it's I've always thought that was very interesting, that looking back fondly, by those who were there at the time, a life carrier resident on Urantia, of how sad it is to record that it's pretty hard to find anyone with the backbone to get to light and life anymore. Yeah. You don't lay on your back and float to life and life. You have to claw your way to light and life. First through a rugged physical environment, then through a even more rugged mental environment, and then even a yet more rugged spiritual environment. And then you bring spirit into your mind, and it's trying to tear you, exalt yourself into iniquity.
My doctor is having me take Prozac, so
I right, so all of the difficulties go away. Yeah.
Do you have a positive note to end this on?
Yes, the positive note is take up the challenge of the life carriers there. See? It's the same challenge up in Paper 16, Section 6. Right? Don't be sad to record. Take up the challenge. You have it. I've said that up front, right? It's a mustard seed. You have everything it takes. Just choose to take a hold of it. You have courage you don't imagine you have. Right? Try using your third adjutant as the spirit of courage. You've just been using it as the energy of loyalty. like loyalty to your tribe, your political tribe or something. Actually, use it as a spirit of courage. You'll be amazed, right, at what you can do. Right? It's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch use the adjutants as the spirit of something. Another way to say that even more poignantly, you do it. Right? And it starts with using the seventh as the spirit of wisdom. And everything flows down and is exalted from there. Right? Approach the adjutants from the top down. Take a hold of them. Begin to master. Supply the favorable conditions for self-mastery.
It's like the Jesus is to the guy who's afraid.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a good body, you've got a good mind. Use your mind. You know, don't let it use you,
right,
so to speak. Don't get fear.
Again,
that's an interesting thing. If you do that, you say, oh, God, mind. Let me figure out. Mm-hmm. Let me think about this. And then, you know, your courage comes in, other things come in.
Yeah.
If you don't let it take you, but you use your God-given talents, you know, to be able to, as you say, I guess, grow up.
What was Jesus encouraging him to do? Be unnatural. Be unnatural, right? And what's the nucleus for being unnatural? Genuine religious consciousness. That's the nucleus of the human, the unnatural fact. The animal is natural, right? The energies of the adjutants are natural. The spirits are unnatural. Spirit of courage is an unnatural use of the third adjutant. It's not a natural thing. It's not naturally there. It's not automatically there. You have to choose to use it as the spirit of courage. Yeah. You have to supply the favorable conditions for it to function as the spirit of courage.
And don't be controlled by fear.
Right. Right. And see, the only way to not be controlled by fear is to let go of fear, which everything is welling up from the fear foundation. Right? You have to turn around. Start with religious consciousness on the sixth level of meaning and work down. And be born again.
And don't be too hooked on the refinements. That's one of the problems we have.
Yeah, right. The material comfort era has lots of fancy refinements, right? An environment, right, that can drag you down again, right, and make you spiritual but not religious. Don't let those material refinements make you spiritual and not religious. Fight against that.
Call the guy who runs
that. Yeah, that's a spiritual battle. See, like I said, I mean, the battles go all the way up from matter through mind to spirit. That's a spiritual battle to be religious and not merely spiritual. Right? That's a genuine spiritual battle.
Religion means what?
Bound back. Religion, you know, bound back to eternity.
Bound back to eternity.
Instead of bound to time. As you are naturally, do the unnatural thing of being bound back to eternity.
You also said religion is, you know, your relation to God and God's relation to you, so to speak, contemplation.
All right. So, so that's how they end on that grand note. When all is said and done, see, with the evolution of man, it's that evolutionary foundation for courageous and independent cosmic thinking that they want to end with. Right? And again, to remind you of that, so you get to rediscover that. It's the same story over and over again. Rediscover your human foundations. Right? Choose to do what glaciers used to force you to do. Mm-hmm. Choose to do it yourself now.
That's definitely a bumper sticker.
All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.